Welcome to this workshop and to the 6th annual conference of the Platypus Affiliated Society. These workshops are meant to present different views of the left. They've been going on since 2011 and have brought such a variety of views going from postmodern anarchism, such as Crime Think, to, for example, the Maoist Party of Canada. Today we have with us Nikos Mayaris, who was born in Athens, Greece, but is currently studying and working in Paris. He is a founding member of the political group for autonomy, which acts in Greece, and the group Lieucommun, based in Paris. From my understanding, both movements are inspired from the same sources. They're influenced by the theoretical works of thinkers such as Cornelius Castoriadis and Christopher Lush. Okay. And yes, I'll let you carry on.
So I have to. It's the first time I'm speaking publicly in English, so I'm quite anguished. So I've prepared something. I'm gonna read it. I think it's gonna be easier for me like that. So I'm both a member of the Greek group, political group for the autonomy, and the Parisian organization Lieucommun, whose name is let's say Zepan. That could be literally translated as common places, since it combines the notion of something common to everybody and of something commonplace, of a platitude. There is also another Greek comrade that participates to both of these groups, so we could say that there is a stable interconnection between the two of them. They have the same theoretical outlook, and we could say that they form the Greek and French versions of the same political undertaking. This means that what I'm going to say goes roughly for both of them, especially if we keep in mind that what my presentation would be mostly theoretically oriented. I know I'm supposed to speak to you about what we do in these groups. That's the aim of the workshop, but I have to admit that both of them have as their main, let's say, preoccupation, that what we like to call theoretical elaboration. So our main activity is our attempt to renovate or maybe revive what was once called revolutionary theory, and what we could nowadays more modestly call emancipatory or democratic theory. That's the terms that we use. So that's why the main part of our activity consists on the publication of a biannual review on Greece and a series of non-periodical brochures in France. So I brought some of them here. I forgot to just have a look.
We'll put them by the exit, yes, before French people ones leave.
So, that in any case implies that we neglect, let's say, the purely practical dimension of politics, since we have actively taken part on what we have considered as major political events of these last years, since the formation of our two groups around 2009. So we had the French social movement of 2010 against the pension system reform, a movement that finally failed. The uprising in Tunisia in 2011, since we have a number of Tunisian comrades in the French group. And the Democracy Now! Movement in Athens at the same time, in the summer of the same year. On these occasions, the main goal of our intervention was articulated around two major axes. Firstly, the critique of leftist bureaucracies and of the recuperating tactics, from the standpoint of direct democracy, and secondly, a critique of the ambient political and ideological, vacuum of the majority of these events that took the form of what we could characterize as veto movements. That is social movements that just oppose the governed politics, very often by defending what was the status quo ante, whatever that may be, without proposing something really new. In any case, the supposedly purely practical dimension of politics is in reality never purely practical, since given the fact that there is no practical political activity that is utterly blind ideologically and theoretically. Even political activity, every political activity reflects a certain set of beliefs, even if it proclaims itself as anti-intellectual and purely activist or practical. In the same time, every theoretical reflection that it is not destined or intentionally reserved to a small minority of revolutionary, let's say, experts. It's a theory that tries to enlighten a democratic praxis, and in the same time is nourished by contradiction and, let's say, cul-de-sac that this praxis faces in everyday life. At least that's how we try to see the relation between theory and praxis in our two groups, because as being inspired by famous Castoriadis saying, according to which emancipatory politics is a thoughtful doing, so a lucid combination of theory and practical activity. So what I'm trying to do is to explain the theoretical reasons why we think that today democratic politics is more and more confined to this attempt to rethink all those things that were and are still going without saying for the major part, not only of the left, but of the anarchist movement as well. And as I already said, a great part of our theoretical production is a reflection on this situation. And more we feel that the current social conditions do not permit democratic or revolutionary groups do much more politically. I would say that we're in a terrible need of a new model, let's say, of democratic and emancipatory paradigm of cultural criticism. And why is that? Because we think that since the rise of the social movements of the 60s, it has become clear enough that the main problem of emancipatory politics lies on, let's say, a radical disjunction of the inner parts of democratic politics that took place during the last four decades, between its strictly political, social or economic dimension on the one hand, and its cultural counterpart on the other hand. It could be said that since the 50s and the decline of the traditional labor movement, not only the working class, but let's say lower classes as a whole, have become quite conservative or even reactionary in a cultural level. And as a reaction to that evolution, the movement of the 60s stressed the importance of an anti-authoritarian critique of, let's say, Puritan bourgeois or petty bourgeois ethics and morality. And that gave rise and definitively consolidate what we could call cultural liberalism as the unsurpassable horizon of modern society. So radical social movements almost completely lost their social base and are now reduced to small, let's say, sects of middle class and bourgeois intellectuals who sometimes, as it is the case with us here, try to meditate on this situation with a view of changing it. But more often they tend to use it as a means of self-justification and even in a self-complacent manner. This is very clear in the case of most versions of contemporary anarchism or, for example, radical feminism, which very usually revolve around the profound fear of that the whole of society is nothing more than the bunch of reactionary fascists. And it is precisely this short-minded mentality that gives rise to what Murray Bookchin has described as lifestyle anarchism. But why stress the importance of all these issues? Because I think, and we think in our groups, that they form the context inside of which we are today compelled to struggle politically and debate theoretically. One could think that we are talking about a quite recent evolution, but it's not at all the case. In reality, it's only the culmination of a long, let's say, social process that is inherent in the historical formation of Western modernity itself. I'll try to explain my point using an example. The French liberal political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville, who was of an aristocratic descent, hence his surname, was stunned by the directness of American manners and political, let's say, mentality when he visited the States in the 1830s, since he was used to European and especially French mentality that was still reproducing many features of the ancient regime worldview, that is, of the social regime of the anti-revolutionary period. So what he called democracy in his famous book Democracy in America wasn't the political regimes of the United States of this period, which for him was a republic, since contrary to contemporary liberal political theorists, Tocqueville wasn't an imbecile, and he was capable of discerning between parliamentary pseudo-democracy and genuine real direct democracy. In any case, what he meant by democracy was the absence of every mode of social hierarchy that was not founded in wealth and social achievement. It was what Melville once described as a ruthless or unconditional democracy. That is a mentality that declares that even a thief in jail is as honorable as a person as General George Washington. We could say that that's the model of society that resembles most to the liberal capitalist dream of a society where the only factor of social differentiation would be one's economic performance and not his origin or social background. Every other form of distinction, founded, for example, on color of his skin, on his origin, sex, race, etc., etc., should be abolished as an archaic hindrance that blocks the functioning of the market, of the free market. That is also the the ideological foundation of meritocratic ideology and of the theory of the trickle-down effect. In any case, it's not just capitalism, it's modernity as a whole, Western modernity, that leads to such a withering away, not of the state, or even just of reactionary and patriarchal mentalities and ideologies, but of society itself as a whole, that is, as a series of man-made conventions, customs, habits, social representation and beliefs that regulate social coexistence and give meaning to human life. So contrary to what Marx thought when elaborating his famous theory on commodity fetishism, the problem with capitalism is not that it adds useless mediations, as the situationists, the French Marxist group would later say, that veil social reality, blocking in addition every expression of social spontaneity. I would dare to say that it is precisely the opposite that is happening. Capitalism steadily destroys every form of collective and social life, every sort of social custom, tradition, and common value or belief, be it reactionary and patriarchal or not. It gradually undermines every form of collective adherence in order to disentangle the supposedly omnipotent and asocial individual from every form of social binding. When liberty is being perceived in terms of possessive individualism, that is, as the individual's capacity to possess things, exerting on them his unhindered control, every sort of social representation or commonly accepted habit is viewed as a danger to individual autonomy and independence. And what is more, such a conception of the human being that was for the first time systematically elaborated in the philosophical level by Thomas Hobbes is only a part of this great transformation that gradually took place in the modern West and gave birth to this absolutely original type of society, whose main, let's say, pillars are the modern rational state, the capitalist economy, and last but not least, technology. That is the properly modern technical system that consists on this merging of technique and science that transforms itself into a materialized ideology that raises its proper expansion to an end in itself. The idea that every human and social institution should be rationally rebuilt from above is the cornerstone of liberalism, that is, of the political project that sums up this social and historical evolution, as it combines its two main liberalism's two main obsessions, its profound individualism and its concomitant contempt for every type of traditional social habit and custom. So it combines this obsession with its technophile aspiration. So the idea is to create from scratch a new type of society, rational, enlightened, and technologically advanced, which will constitute the abode of this totally rational homo economicus, and where the problems raised by social coexistence of these totally individuated and selfish individuals will be resolved automatically through the intervention of the invisible hand of free market and technology. From this point on, every individual should be left alone to pursue what he perceives as happiness, since it is happiness and not freedom, but not political freedom, that moderns are after. Well, it should be clear then that such a great transformation is inconceivable without the creation of a really monstrous and tentacular state apparatus responsible to organize everyday life together with economy and technology, or at least pave the way for the domination of the latter by destroying every trace of traditional social life and replacing it by bureaucratic institutions that facilitate this expansion of techno-economical, let's say, manipulation. Tocqueville had sensed that and spoke of an état tutélaire, what could be nowadays called a nanny state. This utopian capitalism, as a contemporary French historian has very accurately called it, believes that an uncontrolled market could serve as the ultimate foundation of a rational society. But the truth is that it necessarily leads not to a market animated and propelled social automatism, but to the gradual erection of what Christopher Lasch called the therapeutic state, which, with its concomitant culture, inside of which everyday life is subdued to the reign of managers, doctors, various specialists, social engineering experts, scientists or parascientific gurus. The ultimate consequence is the pulverization of the individual and its reduction to a minimal self, deprived of any capacity of coherent thought and independent action. So the major trait of this individual proves to be its growing incapacity of restraining itself from indulging into habits that are harmful to itself and to others. As a consequence, the state has to continuously intervene in order to fix things up. And that leads to a growing police presence in everyday life. As Jane Jacobs once said when she was discussing the causes of urban sprawl and decay that were beginning to appear in so many of the modern cities and megacities, the public peace of cities is not kept primarily by the police, necessary as police are. It is kept primarily by an intricate, almost unconscious network of voluntary controls and standards among the people themselves, and enforced by the people themselves. No number of police can enforce civilization where the normal, casual enforcement of it has been broken down. End of quote. She was then referring just to the street level, trying to analyze what was going wrong to the declining American neighborhoods. But I would say that it goes the same for the scale of society as a whole. That is, the destruction of social bond creates a void that has to be filled up by therapeutic culture and its various tentacles. That means that the growing obsession with police and camera surveillance or security, which really took off after 9/11, is not just a form of premeditated state control that seeks to, let's say, neutralize every form of resistance. It is also an expression of the fast progressing disintegration of every form of social bond. Western societies. As for example, we can read in English or American press, Fargo, the North Dakota city, which has a population of 1,000 people, but averaging fewer than 2 murders a year, has its own SWAT team, SWAT team, with its armored personal carrier with a rotating turret. Keene, a small town in New Hampshire, which had 3 homicides between 1999 and 2012, spent nearly $2,086,000 on an armored personal carrier known as the Bearcat. The local police chief said it would be used to patrol Keene's Pumpkin Festival and other dangerous situations. The mayor of this town, which has a population of 2,000 people, was caught whispering to a councilman that we're going to have our own tank. So, this may sound ridiculous, and it is, and also exaggerated as an excuse, but it reflects, let's say, the general atmosphere and ambience of what happens inside Western megacities. In Paris, for example, every fall we organize the infamous Techno Parade, a ridiculous parade with very loud music, where hundreds of stoned and drunk people march, dancing, screaming, and vomiting in the streets. The only way to control this crowd is the deployment of a massive police force with anti-riot units, whose aim is to protect city and bystanders from the excesses of the participants. And it goes the same for plenty of other massive events, from mega concerts to sport venues. And it is also in France, the homeland of modern bureaucracy, that we have campaigns co-organized by Parisian schools, high schools, and the RATP, that is the city's public transport operator, in order to teach students how to well behave when using the metro or the bus. There are even conferences on sociability and how it works. So in other terms, we could say that in advanced Western societies, we have to explicitly teach those elementary civic virtues and this, let's say, spontaneously emerging civility that we're going without saying for every other type of society, pre-capitalist society. This common decency, as George Orwell used to call it, without which no human society can function and survive for long. Even the most grassroots practices are nowadays being replaced by bureaucratic institutions acting in the name of society. Here we have just one example among many others as to the present state of Western society's anthropological disintegration. The problem, therefore, is not that the presumed revolutionary subject, the proletariat in classic Marxism, the colonially oppressed peoples in third world pseudo-Marxism, the immigrants or the underclass in many versions of contemporary anarchism is in a phase of profound hibernation. If such was the case, we would be speaking of a merely political problem. That is how to politically wake up the sleeping working class, for example. But unfortunately, the problem is far more complicated and profound. It could be said that it is no more just a problem of political nature, since it is steadily acquiring an anthropological dimension as well. What it is at stake today is not just exploitation and inequality, but the survival of the socio-historical world that gave birth to all these emancipatory movements in the political and social level, and to all these radical and critical theories on the intellectual level, philosophical, scientific, and artistic. And behind this decline of the West lies an equally inextricable and brutal crisis of our globalized world as a whole. As D.H. Lawrence once said, trying to allegorically interpret the myth of Moby Dick, and I'm going to finish with this, many races, many people, many nations under the stars and stripes, beaten with many stripes, seeing stars sometimes, the Pequod, that is Ahab's vessel, went down. And the Pequod was the ship of white American soul. She sank, taking with her Negro and Indian and Polynesian, Asiatic and Quaker and good business-like Yankees, end of quote. That is the case today with the West. What we face is the end of a consumer society, a type of society created by the West and quickly embraced by the whole planet, whose peoples are now participating on the former's sinking. The social and ecological consequences of such a wreck are unpredictable, since it is the first time in history that we face such an all-embracing, let's say, civilizational collapse. The whole planet is colonized by the model of and the norms of a sole type of society, modern society, and such colonization leaves no space for new and unknown peoples to come to the fore. The empire is slowly decaying, but there are no barbarians, as in the case of the Roman Empire, to create the society that will replace it. People are no more fighting to create a better world. They are just grasping themselves as tightly as possible from the remnants of our dying world. The global resurgence of radical and far-right parties offers us the political expression of this phenomenon. People are looking for a mafia-type protection that will assure them their existing position within the social hierarchy, permitting them in the same time to avoid any brutal social downgrading, as it is the case in Greece, for example. And in such an environment, where the slightest emancipatory desire is shattered by the need for protection and security, there is little space for the emergence of real democratic social movements. So, what is the role of political groups inside this gloomy context? What other could we do than just repeating the old revolutionary and emancipatory platitudes on equality and social justice that are now being forgotten more and more? It is a question that, as far as our groups are concerned, is constantly haunting us, without having found an adequate answer. So, I pose it again here, in order to spark the debate.
Well, who doesn't understand English very well, you did excellent, my dear.
Because I have it written in Latin.
So, very good.
So we'll begin with questions. Yes.
Thank you, Nikos, for your presentation. I was wondering if you consider yourself, your groups, given your anti-Leninism, if you consider yourself a vanguard in any sense. I mean, do you try to win and exert power theoretically or politically among movements, practical, or movements of thought? So I would like you, how you imagine the way that you could lead, given your anti-Leninism especially. Also, I would like to, if you could, specify a bit on the problem of democracy, because you mentioned direct democracy, and it is as if transhistorically you see a conflict between direct democracy and oligarchy, or autonomy and heteronomy, and if there is any historical specification of this problem in modernity. I mean, modernity allows for mass form of politics, and how your vision of direct democracy is not a romantic and the modernist, etc. And also, I would like you a bit to clarify your critique on Marx, because you briefly mentioned a small critique on fetishism. If it is possible to clarify a bit more, because I didn't get it. Sorry.
So, let's begin with the question on the existence or not of, let's say, a vanguard mentality in our groups. I would say that deeply within ourselves, we consider ourselves as, let's say, a theoretical vanguard organization, in the sense that we try to reflect on what is happening, what is going on, so... And we try to have a critical approach compared to what we see, at least in France, as being considered left-wing or even the libertarian and anarchist. So we consider that compared to them, we are really far in advance, as far as the theoretical elaboration is concerned. But politically speaking, we do not consider that we should... clearly and openly present ourselves as a vanguard, because we do not think that we are, we cannot offer the solutions to what society is going to do in case of a social uprising. Of course, we are going to actively participate and diffuse our ideas, try to and that's the case in every time we participate politically within the social movements, we try to diffuse our ideas and even and not only propose better ways of organizing, because we consider ourselves are as far more politically experienced as, for example, people that non-affiliate,
unaligned
people that for the first time come to participate to grassroots procedures. But we do not want to dictate. We just take part, let's say, in the AG. Assembly
General. General Assembly, the gatherings.
The gatherings, we participate in an equal basis and propose things. The only, let's say, case in which we became, let's say, a little bit more Leninist, it's, and we, yes, we try to, we think that it's necessary to give some preemptive strikes, is in order to protect the grassroots procedures from bureaucratic recuperation. For example, if you know that you have members of, let's say, a Stalinist organization or of a Maoist organization that try to infiltrate the movement in order to take the power, so even even not in a quite legal manner, we think that you are justified to go and fight against them because you know what's going to happen, what's going to follow. And so it is the only, let's say, the only occasion in which we justify ourselves in acting in a more Leninist manner. But generally speaking, we think that the ideal model for a group, a political group that tries to has articulate theoretical reflection, is to have some, let's say, a porosity. That is, its members should participate in grassroots movements, be it a syndicate or another movement, a neighborhood movement, in order to gain ideas and experience that can nourish theoretical elaboration, and in the meantime try to influence this movement according to the ideas of the group. So, as far as democracy is concerned, I think that the problem of founding a political regime of direct democracy in a mass scale is a real problem. But we should keep in mind that if we're talking about the abolition of a capitalist economy, it goes without saying that we have to very profoundly decentralize modern societies. For example, having cities of 2, 3, 5, 6 million of people is something completely crazy. We do not have need of such great cities. The only case in history that we had such great cities was Oriental despotist regimes, as China, for example, that needed such great cities in order to consolidate the ultimate power of the monarchs. And then we have capitalist, the modern capitalist society with its concentration of economical forces and productive means of production that creates such big cities. But such big cities are inhumane, and I think that we have to radically decentralize society. So if we talk about communes of, I don't know, 10,000 people, for example, the model of direct democracy, I think it's viable. It can work. Because when we say direct democracy, and you have a population of 10,000 people, let's say that you have 5,000 people, or even if you have 20,000 people with 10,000 adult members that are supposed to participate in political, in the taking of decisions, they will not be every time present. So we need, let's say, a basis of 5,000, 6,000 people to make it work, and I think it can work like that. Concerning now the problematics of heteronomy and autonomy, I think there we have to address a critique to David Graeber and other neo-anarchists that confound the direct democracy with autonomy. So they find, let's say, primitive societies that were not statist society, so societies, and they present them as a model of liberated society. But I think that it's not at all the case. And why is that? Because if you have a, let's say, patriarchal society where a small society, a small tribe that has no need of a state, why? Because you have the elder generation that, or ancient wisdom that is supposed to automatically regulate social life, we could say that we have there a proto-direct democracy, but profoundly, in an anthropological level, we have a profoundly reactionary society that it's not at all autonomous. So you can have an heteronomous society that it's in the political, in a strictly political level, could appear as semi-democratic. And finally, to address the question on Marx and our critique, that it is also linked to the problem of heteronomy and autonomy, we could say that for Marx, capitalism is a form of heteronomy. Why? Because it veils social reality. So it introduces part of the superstructure is all this legal and ideological arsenal that serves to completely hide what's really going on in the level, in the material level. So it is the idea that we have to abolish all this and really liberate social and economical factors that in the final level of communist society we're going to function completely in another spontaneity. No need of social conventions, no need of political or social institutions. We, as far as our groups are concerned, we think that this is a utopian point of view. We will even in a really egalitarian and democratic, let's say, socialist society, we're going to have need of a means of regulating social life. So we think that the problem with capitalism is that it gradually but steadily destroys every form of social regulation, real social regulations that comes from the bottom up, and it's acting in the grassroots level, be it reactionary or patriarchal or not. And that's why we have such a problem nowadays, because capitalism and consumer society have completely disintegrated society, and it's more and more difficult for people to really engage in a coherent manner in political undertakings, even against capitalism.
Very well, in the back.
Oh, sure. So I want to raise a question about how you conceive of the purpose of cultural criticism on the left. And I guess to unpack that a little bit, it seems like there are a few ways that the left can relate to that project. You know, starting back in, I believe, the communist, the old left communist party, there is this idea of making communism as American as apple pie. And so there was an intense resistance to this kind of thoroughgoing cultural criticism. And you see that taken up then again by the new left, the New America movement into the DSA. And even through today, some of the editors of Japanese magazine never fail to mention at each event that they're about to watch a sports game later. You know, so you still see this on the left, this this idea of kind of sidestepping that cultural criticism. You know, among Orthodox Trotskyists, there tends to be a seemingly more attractive relegation of those issues to one's private life. In other words, we're waking up the working class, but we don't need to undertake or take seriously social psychology or cultural criticism. Those aren't really political issues. Then, of course, on the other side, like those who are undertaking that work tend to be in the academy, and it's often unclear, you know, even if you look at the history of the Frankfurt School, how that can potentially translate into some kind of political result. And then often, I think on the European left, many who take the cultural criticisms of the Frankfurt School seriously end up in this kind of, you know, the personalist political, mm-hmm. let's live in squats, let's throw out our televisions, that sort of thing. And that, too, doesn't seem to pose any way of advancing beyond capitalism. So I guess my question is, like, do you kind of see yourself in that same Frankfurt School imagination of, you know, in the context of regression and barbarism, just sending messages in the bottle, trying to maintain this consciousness, or would there be an end to cultural criticism in the sense of it actually pointing to something more, more like a viable left project?
It's a real problem, because I can, even if I'm, I disagree with political conclusions of late Adorno, let's say, I really I really understand and I have a profound sympathy for the reasons that made him reach these conclusions. I think that mass culture. That's why I stress the importance of technology with its tentaculous diffusion. I think that we have an unprecedented, degradation of human being. That's an ecological problem rarely posed. That is, we have not only to deal with the degradation of the ecosystems, but also with the degradation of human being as the being capable of creating and imagining things. For example, take the example of this infernal machine, the iPhones. So, it's really an infernal machine. Why? Because I work with students and I work in Paris. So this year I work in a bourgeois high school. So you are supposed to deal with students that come from wealthy and really cultural enlightened families, etc., etc. But it's utter. You would say that catastrophe. Why is that? In a certain practical level, because they have, for example, the iPhone in their pocket. The whole world knowledge is in your pocket, so there's no more need to exert your memory, for example. There's no more need to have critical, even in a functional level. So steadily, but progressively, we become numb and dumb. So I think that if you compare the, an individual of the youngest generations of today's society and try to make a catalog of what he's capable of doing in everyday life, he's completely incapable of surviving in a society without electricity and gas. He's known nothing. He knows nothing. And if you compare him, let's say, with a boy of not even coming from, let's say, a primitive people that was capable of knowing all the fauna and, of his village, so as to know what type of mushroom to eat, what type of mushroom to not eat, etc., etc., and that he's capable to reconstruct the whole of his social edifice in case of a catastrophe. No, I just want to compare a contemporary youngster with a guy of his age, but he lived, let's say, 30, 40, 60 years ago. We have a terrible degradation, so the principal actors of this degradation is mass culture and neo-technology. So I think that Adorno's posture is real tempting, but Adorno was a bourgeois who considered himself as a real avant-garde thinker. So you can do no politics like that. If you want to do real politics, you have to say that you are no longer acting as a avant-garde movement. Because if you do so, you become, a bohemian. That's the major problem that the French surrealists faced. They try to stay, to keep it real in the intellectual and poetic level, but in the same time be politically engaged. It was really difficult. We had only André Breton and Benjamin Perret that managed to do both. So the rest... whether became Trotskyist, and completely abandoned the intellectual and cultural criticism, where they became just avant-garde artists with no political engagement. And just to finish my point, I would say that today we have the two extremes that we have to evite.
Avoid.
So, in one hand, we have what we could call, following Bookchin, lifestyle anarchism. That is a degenerated version of the new left and modernist cultural criticism that consists in creating liberated spaces in occupations and stuff like that. And we render political even the way that we go, that we eat or we go to the toilet. Everything is political, so it just suffices to lead to live in a certain way, and that's why that's how capitalism is going to be abolished. And the other extreme is a certain liberally oriented approach that consists in saying that we do not at all touch questions of private life. It's a question of private life, so we need you just to be engaged and really militant in street level, participating in an organization, even, let's say, after the Platypus conference, we can go and, I don't know, let's say, act as the most capitalist, the worst capitalist. That is the two extremes, and I think that there are two forms of adhering without knowing to the dominating cultural liberalism. That is, that everything is just a question of style. And on the other hand, everything is just a question of the individual should be left alone, do whatever he wants. Every form of criticism of his way of life, it's a fascist attempt to control him.
Many things I wanted to kind of address. It's funny, I found myself, you know, sympathetic to the portrayal you gave of, this decline of kind of modern society and its disintegrative effects on the individual, but then was somewhat taken aback by some of the kind of political outlooks, you know, forward-looking political outlooks. I mean, I find it shocking, the idea that we would just, you know, decentralize the cities and live in groups of 10,000. I mean, the only way I could ever possibly imagine that happening would be through an incredibly authoritarian, top-down, you know, regime. I mean, the closest that I suppose has ever come to that is Cambodia and, you know, the evacuation of the cities, and it seemed pretty bad then.
Not true.
Okay, whatever. But I guess my real question, because I don't know if I can fully, engage in a criticism of those outlooks. I guess my question that I really wanted to pose to you is, how do you, in this narrative of the kind of decline of modernity and its, negative effects upon individuals and the capacity of individuals to engage in, substantive social relations and conscious political action, and also, engage in a kind of open-ended process of the development of consciousness, how do you then explain your own position in that historical situation? I mean, it seems like that's an incredibly important task in order to not only kind of make sense of your own possibility, but also to perceive its potential for generalization. Not only is the question, okay, well, I don't like iPhones, I don't have one in my life, therefore I'm able to read theory and have an open mind, therefore, but yeah, I mean, most people have an iPhone, so if your political outlook and theoretical consciousness is in any way generalizable, it would have to be applicable to people who have been brought up in the era of this technological penetration into our subjectivity. And so on what basis is your politics generalizable in this historical context? I mean, yeah, I guess that I'll leave it at that. Because I also wouldn't mind if you addressed something of, you know, how you can make these kind of, suggestions of what the future kind of emancipation might look like without it just devolving into a reactionary romantic. I mean, what ultimately strikes me is a very kind of similar strain of a primitivist anarchism, you know, where it's like the best thing to do would be to go out and like mushroom farm or like harvest. I mean, I like that stuff. I grew up in the country, like I'm all about it, but I just don't think that it's something that can be said to be like in the future of humanity's interest. But anyways.
No, you're right. You stress a really complicated point. And I'd say that's why I prefer to make a presentation of our theoretical outlook, so we could debate. But because we're finding ourselves more and more in, let's say, an Adornian position. We know that current society is not at all viable for ecological and anthropological reasons, not just because of the economical crisis and capitalism. And we know that social auto-transformation that is needed in order to create a really viable society are tremendous, and people are not at all interested in something like that. So I see it as a dead end. For me, emancipatory politics is finished. We're heading towards the new Middle Ages that it's going to be far worse than the real Middle Ages, which was quite good at the time. No, Middle Ages was a quite good period, emancipatory movements, etc., etc. So I have no answer. Your remark is really goes straight to the core of the problem. That's why I stressed the importance of cultural criticism, because for us, cultural criticism is not just, let's say, something that we have to put together with political struggle. That's why we use the term anthropological approach, because for us now the problem is we need a major reconstruction of social bond itself. That's the problem. And the problem is that given the catastrophes that are going to come, surely ecological ones, either you're going to have a really authoritarian eco-fascist regime that's going to say we have to impose some limits or not the earth is going to explode, or else the only alternative to me is a radical and very profound auto-transformation into a democratic or socialist direction. But I think what is most probable historically is the first perspective. Because I think that there are no more social movements capable of being the actors of such a tremendously radical and all engulfing transformation.
Your question, you no longer have it.
I do have a question. I wanted to kind of clarify for you to clarify your invocation of Tocqueville, because I don't think I fully followed that when I was trying to listen to the reading. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because I thought that you were talking about it in connection with this idea of like a legacy of unconditional or ruthless democracy. That made me think, this idea of direct democracy, I think, is actually somewhat inimical to Tocqueville's thought in his criticism of the development of radical equality that he saw as manifesting in this concept of the tyranny of public opinion. So my question would be, I don't know how important this is if we're to imagine some sort of like auto-transformation into socialism as our best bet, but this problem of like, what is the difference between direct or radical democracy and the tyranny of public opinion as it currently exists?
I think that Hannah Arendt has a very well thought formulation, precisely trying to answer this question. And she said that direct democracy is not the domination of the majority. Direct democracy is just a form of taking decisions. So the tyranny of the majority is something else. And before that, we should make, let's say, a distinction. Tocqueville was referring, let's say, to the cultural level. And we are speaking here, we're referring to the, when talking of, speaking of direct democracy, we're talking, we're referring to the political level. I think the real problem lies in the cultural level. Because Tocqueville, for me, is one of the, maybe the, between the two or three most important thinkers of modernity, because imagine the guy, he came here in the 1830s, and he wrote things that can help us really comprehend what's going on today within a consumer society. I think that what he described as democracy, and that's why I used Melville's term, radical democracy or ruthless democracy, I think it's something good, and it's something that we should keep. Because for everyone that comes from the old world, and especially from France, we can very profoundly sense the differences between this egalitarian spirit that exists in the United States and the ancient mentality that continues to exist in France. For example, France, it's you have state institutions that are not regulated by any judicial. They have no judicial status. We say that they are the. We call them the grand corps. That is, let's say, the great bodies. That is the upper strata of public function. Whose public servants, bureaucrats and servants come from special schools that are considered as higher from even the, let's say, Ivy League universities. And all this is founded on customs. Why? Because it's a direct continuation of what was going on during Louis XIII, Louis XIV, the French monarchs. So, and French society is stratified in a manner far more, let's say, vertical and than American society. For example, in France, especially in Paris, you have no real social mixité, merging. So this ruthless democracy, I think, is a cultural expression of a real democratic spirit in the political level. And we have to keep this. It's something really positive. But the problem is, it makes it what it's exactly what made the American capitalism so strong. That's why I said that capitalism ideally it has no need. It's egalitarian in the anthropological and cultural level. For capitalism, we should all be equal. So as a free market can function unhindered and people can consume, produce, that's the problem. And I think the left has a major problem on addressing this question. Because for the major part of the left and of the anarchists, capitalism is supposed to be reactionary, Puritan. No, I think that was just a period in capitalist history.
I was curious about the kind of
Tocqueville. Just something I forgot. That's why I referred to Tocqueville, because Tocqueville was the first to really theorize this characteristic of American society. And he really grasped this mechanism of modernity that leads to a further and further disintegration of every social custom, bond, or institution that is not, let's say, economically founded.
We have 15 minutes remaining, so if you could keep it to 5 minutes per question, we'll try to get three.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious if you can contextualize the type of cultural criticism practice, if only because cultural criticism
in some ways no longer seems very viable. At least in the 19th century, cultural criticism was very viable, and it seemed to anticipate political thinking in a way. But for Adorno, the cultural critic was the salary nuisance of bourgeois society. So in a way, it was this way in which bourgeois society kind of pointed beyond itself. It sort of contradicted itself in a way in which cultural criticism today doesn't seem to have that imminence to it. The way that cultural criticism is practiced today often has this, it actually has a political ideology and it's built into its practice where the cultural critic sees itself as being outside of society in some way and like in a position to judge without. And it's very different. So I'm just curious if cultural criticism can even be done. Because what I gather is that from you think that we're kind of thrown back into some, like after political defeat, we're thrown back into bohemia. But in a way, we're thrown back into something worse than bohemia. Like, we can't really be thrown back into bohemia in the same way.
Exactly, because at least the real modernists and bohemians were great artists. but today, it's total mediocrity that mediocrity that reigns. So I'd say that in order precisely to avoid this dead end, we try to have what I call an anthropological approach. That is to say that today a critique of, let's say, capitalism cannot be coherent without a critique of modern way of life in general, consumer society, etc., etc. So the two main axes of our critique, it is the technology, neo-technology, and also the growth, because we are inspired also of a French movement, the degrowth movement, that says that it's okay, we have sufficiently enough wealth accumulated. The question is the redistribution of wealth, not just the liberation of productive forces in order to produce far more wealth. No, we could say that sound quite not only a Khmer Rouge, but also Malthusian, because we think, for example, that Earth's population should find a way to limit Earth's population. If we think that everybody should live in a humane way, and given the ecological boundaries of the planet, it's not viable for, let's say, 10 billions of people to live in a way without dying of a famine, for example. So in order to get out of this mentality that puts economy in the center of every social interest, we have to change the way of life. But in the meantime, we have also to overthrow the social and economical institutions and structures that incarnate this way of life and thinking.
And Richard?
A few points. First, it's important that you draw our attention again to the work of de Tocqueville. However, the study of the New England town meetings is a subject that is completely disregarded in this country. You don't find any attention given to it in the American Political Science Association. You don't see any courses in universities, apart from the University of Vermont in Burlington, that deals with the existing town meeting phenomena that is still going on in the seven New England states. Mm-hmm. This is very significant. And insofar as it kept in the area of ignorance, it is corroded systematically and corrupted. The only person who has done important contemporary work on that is a man by the name of Frank Bryant, who lives and teaches in Burlington, and who has written an important book, contemporary book called Real Democracy, published by the University of Chicago Press. That's number one. Number two, in response to Theo's attempt to entrap you by referring to vanguard Leninism. You know, I'm not aware of Leninists ever infiltrating an organization to protect the organization from an authoritarian takeover. But I do want to draw your attention to the Spanish Five, who has specifically had the obligation, the moral and political obligation, to be constantly on the watch against any growth of authoritarianism, either in the trade union movement or in the society in general. The Five is a very good case study for a person who wants to play that kind of a very important role in society. On direct democracy, and I speak to you as a person who has a certain ethnic legacy. You know, the Greeks are the worst in understanding the contemporary research that has been done on Greek direct democracy.
If you could synthesize all of this into a question quickly.
Well, it's a statement, and I invite a response.
Okay.
It's another form of the heuristic method. The Polis Institute at the University of Copenhagen, for example, has carried on some very significant research as to what and how direct democracy functions. And let us bear in mind a few statistics. The male population that attended the citizen assemblies went from 20 to 30,000 on the PNICs, and the quorum was 6,000. The quorum was 6,000. Now, you try to figure out what kind of political assembly was taking place that could make major decisions at the international level, as well as the domestic level, in an orderly manner, in quotation marks, and functioned accordingly. I mean, we have to look at that when we talk about direct democracy. We have to examine it in a new way. My last point is this, on simple societies. There are simple societies, I don't like, of course, like you, to use the word primitive, simple societies, and I would urge us to look at the Iroquois Confederacy. The Iroquois Confederacy was a long-lasting confederation of seven tribes that had a moral leadership, which included male and female elders who advised the functioning of the Confederacy. And it was a form of direct democracy. So maybe David Gerber doesn't know about the Iroquois Confederacy, but we can turn our attention to it.
Your response to all this?
It's true that there are plenty of things that we can study historically. For example, I didn't know that. I knew some stuff on the Iroquois. But what I wanted to attack was a simplistic view of some things that try to, idolize an innocent and well-functioning past of non-Western societies. On the other stuff, I completely agree. And I will just the final point on direct democracy. We are now preparing a brochure like this one with a French group, where we are trying to describe a possible model of an egalitarian society, an egalitarian ecological society, capable of being articulated around the model of direct democracy, and we are trying to describe a functioning not of just a local commune, but let's say of a society that would have the dimensions of a modern state, for example, modern France. But in an organization not state organized.
Start with Paris,
for example.
So
there you have plenty of things that maybe seem practical, but are very important, or just organizational, that are very important politically speaking. And then, for example, the number of people that participate, all this stuff, it's very important. So, right,
behind you, actually. you want to have left? No, you. Yeah, last question.
I found your use of very, very interesting. But I'm wondering if we really need in the same way. I mean, in the manifesto, Marx talks specifically about the way in which the hallowed old traditions were hollowed out by the callous entertainment. But also the discussion of Adorno. I mean, as it's a bit of a stereotypical one, right? The Mandarin Marxist cultural critic. Whereas there's a little bit more of a complicated view of Adorno if we look at him in exile and then back in the FDR. So in exile, he's the cultural critic in America, right? The culture industry as mass deception. But when he goes back in 49, he is political critic, right? Talking about the genuine spirit of democracy that he encountered in the United States. Whereas in West Germany, it seems just to be a kind of adherence to the formal rules of the game, which is really anticipating the APO and the students' movement. And in many ways, they had a very complex and contradictory relationship to the students, who undertook a genuine kind of, in a way, the project was to democratize the society. So I mean, I think there's a bit of a, you know, kind of contrapuntal Adorno, in a sense, we need to pay attention to. So there's these other sources that could be drawn upon equally as Toklo's point of view in response.
No, I very highly regard Adorno, especially, even if I not always agree with what he explicitly said, because I think he really experienced in almost corporal manner these contradictions, and he tried to find the solution. So I think that it's very important from this point of view, and I totally agree with what you said.
Okay.
Yes, I was wondering if you still believe that cultural criticism is possible when it's so embedded in consumer culture. I mean, I guess I would kind of argue that, like, critics, I mean, yes, there's criticism and attempts to now see things from, like, the outside, as stated earlier, but culturally, all of society seems so embedded in this consumer lifestyle that I was wondering if it's even still possible to critique culture.
I have no answer, because if you try to...
I mean, you kind of talked about, like, bohemia and how, like, we don't have bohemia anymore, how at least the bohemians back then could make good arts. And now there seems to be, like, this dead end to art.
No, I think we have a total cultural collapse. So, because at the time it was easy to attack bourgeois morality. It was something that existed. We attacked it from, let's say, anti-authoritarian standpoint. We have to liberate creational urges, etc., etc. But today, we have utter void, so we have to recreate it, the whole thing from the scratch, and that's why it's really difficult. And especially if we keep in mind that consumer society is based on a recuperation of the whole bohemian discourse that took place during the 60s. So, what is the core of consumer society? The glorification of this supposedly creational and uninhibited individual. So you have nothing to attack, because even the dominant culture tells you that you are free to do whatever you want. So and I'm finished with that. A German university professor once told me in Paris, he was visiting a professor, and he is studying the subculture, the youth subcultures. And he was telling us, and I told him that it's because he had he thought that youth subcultures are contesting subcultures that from the underground attack dominant culture, etc., etc. And I said that I wasn't at all agree with that. I wasn't agreeing with that. And he told me, yes, maybe you're right, because I remember that when I was young, It was enough just to put an earring, and that created a whole revolution in the family. Now, in societies that have that, for example, in Greece, if you are all tattooed, maybe they're not gonna hire you in the job. But even in France, you can wear whatever you want. Culturally, it's utter freedom. That's not the problem.
So we'll end on this note. Nikos will also be at the panel on the concept of the left at 3:15, and later at the closing plenary. So if you have any further questions, you'll be able to.